Unless you've been under a rock this week, there's one word that you've heard in the news that's re-entered our vocabulary with great intensity, and it's the word scandal, right? And just to remind you of the definition, it's an event or it's an idea that provokes offense or outrage. That's what a scandal is, right? And if you missed it, that's fine. I'm not going to catalog what constituted a scandal this week. I'm not even going to comment about whether the scandals are scandals or to what extent they might be. But I think if I can take a wholly dispassionate view of what's happened this week, the story unfolded in three chapters. One, people brought to light certain events or ideas that caused some people's eyes, some furrowed brows to occur, things that might constitute what some would call a scandal. And then others would chime in about why this, in fact, was so scandalous to the American mindset, to humanity all over, to common decency, some might suggest. And then finally, everyone begins to respond to the claim that there are scandals afoot. Some would deny it, that there was a scandal. Others would exaggerate it. Some would minimize it. Many would try to capitalize on it. Regardless, what happened in every respect, one thing everyone did was follow it. Because everybody loves a scandal. There is a theme in the Old Testament that God is going to bring his salvation to the earth in a way that will scandalize his people. That is, he's going to work in such a way that it's going to offend their expectations, offend their sensibilities so much that some will reject it as if it were not from God at all. And the New Testament picks up that theme to say that Jesus is the scandal. He's the one who offends. He's the one who's going to bring restoration to the earth, but in such a way that it's going to challenge and chafe conventional thinking. He's going to offend because he will be unlike anything or anyone what was they were expecting. And he will scandalize because there are going to be some who thought they were righteous whom Jesus will declare anything but righteous. It will be a scandal that he brings to the earth. And for as long as we've been studying Mark's gospel, ever since we started back in February, you and I have seen that Jesus is unafraid to offend. He will break with tradition in so many ways, and that will scandalize many, and our passage this morning is only going to reaffirm how Jesus is a scandal. But in another sense, is going to amplify why he is. And the question you might be asking is, what's the point? Why bother with trying to explain why Jesus might be a scandal? It's actually twofold. If you and I don't see Jesus in some sense as an offense to how you and I ordinarily think, then you probably don't get him. But if you never get past how he is an offense, then you never will get him. That's why we got to talk about why he's a scandal. And this passage this morning is going to address the scandalous nature of Jesus and his gospel by answering three questions. One, what is it about Jesus that's a scandal? Two, why is he a scandal? And three, what do we do with the fact that he is a scandal? What about him is a scandal? Why is he a scandal? And what do we do with the fact that he is a scandal? So, would you stand as we read from Mark chapter 9? It's the passage you know of as the Transfiguration. We'll start in chapter 2 and go all the way to verse 13. Mark chapter 9, starting in verse 2. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. And his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it's good that we're here. Let us make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." For he didn't know what to say, for they were terrified. And a cloud overshadowed them. And a voice came out of the cloud, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what this rising from the dead might mean. And they asked him, "Why did the scribes say that first Elijah must come?" And he said to them, "Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it is written of him." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. My first two points are really one, so I'm going to kind of go back and forth about explaining what about Jesus is a scandal and why is he a scandal. So don't become disoriented as I might go back and forth there. But the first reason we would say that Jesus presents something to us that he's a scandal is that Mark means to tell us that Jesus is more than a mere man. You remember from last week, Jesus asks the disciples, "Who do you say I am?" And Peter blurts out, "You're the Christ." In other words, Peter had come to believe by that moment in Jesus' ministry that Jesus was one who was specially and uniquely equipped to represent God and accomplish his purposes. And now here in this passage, Jesus is going to confirm to Peter, James, and John just how right Peter is. And let me set this up with a little bit of an illustration. When I took my kids to NASA down in Houston, you get on the tram, you go sit in Mission Control, you go look at a few rocks, you hear about how these mighty men got on big, large bombs and went up into the Earth's atmosphere and then came back down again and survived. And so they have this picture in their mind. Okay, great, spaceflight, fantastic, lovely. But when you approach the giant warehouse on the grounds of NASA, it was my privilege to lead my kids inside that giant warehouse and then watch their eyes widen when they feast their eyes on the Saturn V rocket, the largest thing that has ever gone into space. A full, not just a mock-up, but a rocket that would have gone up had they had the funding to do so. A massive Saturn V rocket exploded out into its multiple stages. My kids, in that moment, they'd had a taste of what spaceflight was about, but they had never seen something that colossal to confirm how colossal a project was the space program. Jesus is about to do something similar for Peter, James, and John. He's going to take these three to the top of a high mountain, and his entire appearance is going to take on a kind of brilliance that they had never seen before, a whiteness that was unparalleled in ever their imagination. It was as if Isaiah 6 was coming back to life, where Isaiah sees the glory of God and sees the brilliance of God and can do nothing but bow before him. And then Jesus, in that brilliance, will begin conversing with no less than Elijah and with Moses. And after Peter makes this sort of oddball suggestion, which we'll get to later in the sermon, a cloud envelops Jesus and Moses and Elijah and almost cuts them off, this wall of cloud that separates those three from the three disciples. And a voice from heaven says, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him." And then it all vanishes. And it's just Jesus and three dumbfounded disciples. What is all that about? For those of you in the room that think that this moment strains incredulity, you have to think of it this way. If Jesus was risen from the dead, and you have to account that every gospel account accounts for that, and it's beyond comparison or beyond your imagination that anyone could be risen from the dead 3 days after it. And Mark gives no suggestion that he's speaking sort of in a metaphorical way. If you can believe that the resurrection might be true, then why can't this true moment be also true for you? Get past the amazingness or the astonishment that they might have been feeling for a moment and respect the fact that it might just well have happened. And if it did, what did it mean? The disciples had already seen plenty that impressed them about Jesus, but this was on an order of magnitude far higher than what they'd come to know about him. Peter had already acknowledged that Jesus was the anointed one, but seeing Jesus as so brilliantly white and in conversation with Elijah and Moses and designated a beloved son, that would set him apart. but it would set him apart as one who was more than just somebody that spoke or led with conviction. The experience on that mountain itself would confirm that Jesus was more than they had expected. But Jesus invites those three guys to the top of that mountain that they would experience something that would remind them of another moment in Israel's history. There's too many correspondences by what goes on in Mark chapter 9 and what happens in the book of Exodus for Peter, James, and John to miss the point. Don't turn there now, but if you were to go to Exodus 24, God invites Moses to the top of Mount Sinai and makes him sit there for 6 days. And then on the seventh day, invites him to come hear from him. And in that passage in Exodus 24, God calls Moses to remember the covenant. And then later in Exodus 33, Moses is invited to meet with God, but with no one else, at what was called the tent of meeting. How apt, right? A meeting place. The tent of meeting. That was, in Israel's day, before they're in their land, the portable place of worship. It's the place that was the precursor to the temple. And whenever Moses would come to the tent of meeting and meet with God, his own face would begin to shine. And he would descend from Mount Sinai, or he would come from the tent of meeting, and the brilliance of his face would alarm everyone that had seen him, such that he would put a veil over his face so that they would not be frightened for long. It's a text that we remember from our affirmation of faith this morning from 2 Corinthians 3. It's the correspondences between those moments in Israelite history and this moment in Mark chapter 9 that's meant to communicate that, one, Jesus is no second-string representative of God. He might have been born in austerity, but don't let that fool you about where he really comes from. And that though Jesus is in the same prophetic company as Elijah and Moses, no prophet, no leader had ever been said, "This is my beloved Son." Hebrews 3, the author of Hebrews says in chapter 3, verse 5, "Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant to testify to the things that were to be spoken later, but Christ is faithful over God's house as a son." Jesus becomes a scandal when we see that he's meant to be understood as more than a man. More than a prophet like Elijah or Moses. More in the sense that unlike any before or after, he is known as the one beloved Son. That's what would and still does raise furrowed brows. Now, why is that a scandal? Why is that in some ways meant to chafe our expectations or our sensibilities? Why would it offend? Well, in that day, it's pretty clear. Anyone who says Jesus is greater than Moses and who is designated the beloved Son of God, that person is asking for a fight. You might remember in John 8, when Jesus says that if you follow him, you'll never taste death. And what do the Pharisees say? They say, "Abraham died. Are you saying that you're greater than Abraham?" And Jesus says, "Before Abraham was, I am." What's their response? It's not to stroke their beards. It's to pick up stones and want to kill him. He's a scandal for making those kinds of comments that he might be more than what they think he is. Now, why is it a scandal today? Why would that claim to authority be scandalous to us? You already know. To say that Jesus is more than a man in the full sense of what that means is perceived in our day as the height of arrogance. Call him learned, fine. Don't call him Lord. Call him wise, but divine, that's a bridge too far. Call him as one, somebody with God consciousness, but don't call him God. Modern ears are scandalized by that sense that he might be more than a man, because modern ears operate on a belief that all major faith traditions are essentially saying the same thing, and therefore there is no optimal way, and stop saying it as if there was. Now, the goal behind that sensibility has a nobility to it. History will reveal too many times of one's assertion of the supremacy of a faith as an excuse for not just incivility, but for barbarism. And so we get it why people would be motivated to say, hey, they're all just saying the same thing, because they've seen in history what people would do when they began to believe that their faith was the faith. And yet, two things are wrong with that premise. Two things are wrong with the belief that says, we're all just saying the same thing, it's just a matter of different trappings and texts. One, that's not a true statement, and two, it's hypocrisy. What do I mean? The premise isn't true, because anybody that does even the slightest investigation to everything that every faith says will find that there are dramatically different perspectives therein. Stephen Prothero wrote a book called God Is Not One. It came out a couple years ago. And he went on to say that Christians, quote, do not go on the Hajj to Mecca. Muslims do not profess their faith in the Trinity. Anyone who says otherwise is not paying attention. And anyone who says such differences do not matter is condescending. Whenever anyone tells me all religions are different paths up the same mountain, I ask them what stands at the peak. And not surprisingly, they tell me different things. What unites the religions is belief in God, some say. But others say the unity of God and humanity lies at the heart of each. And still others insist that the apex of all religions is compassion. So even among religious lumpers, we find religious diversity. Moreover, in every case, we see thinkers unwittingly remaking other religions in their own image. What Prothero was trying to say, and he's no evangelical Christian. He's no conservative fellow. He's saying, look, aspiring to maintain peace within a pluralistic setting is a noble goal and it ought to be sought. Just don't do it by trying to play the card that all faiths are the same. You can't achieve mutual respect by being universally disrespectful, by lopping off the corners and the hard edges of every faith tradition. Even the Dalai Lama knows that all faiths are not the same. When asked, can one be a Buddhist and a Christian? He said, to say that one can be a Buddhist Christian is like trying to put a yak's head on a sheep's body. It can't be done. Stop trying. It's a false premise. It's a false belief. Nobly goals notwithstanding, it's a false premise. And it's also hypocritical to say that all faiths are the same and therefore not one of them can ever be supreme. Why do I say it's hypocritical? Because it's guilty of its own accusation. You've probably heard the example in the past that was put forth by I don't remember who, but it was the idea that all religions are like blind men who are all touching the part of an elephant, right? The elephant is there, and they're all holding on to one piece of the elephant, and one faith tradition says, oh, the elephant is like the religion or truth is like a trunk. No, no, truth is like a tail. No, no, truth is like a leg. No, truth is like an ear, right? But none of them have the whole truth. And therefore, any of them to assert that they have the whole truth is false. But what's wrong with the parable? It assumes that there's somebody that's standing up on a platform that can see that the elephant is many things and that the rest of us are blind. Well, what's the accusation of modern sensibility? That we're all blind, except them. It's hypocritical to assume that no one can be right. Because by that very accusation, you're assuming that you can see all things too. Jesus is more than a man, and he's a scandal to this world. But he's also a scandal to you and me who are in the church. You know how? If Jesus is more than a man, if he's greater than Moses and Elijah, if he's God in the flesh, then you and I are entirely answerable to him for absolutely every single thing in your life. What you think about, what words you choose, what feelings you indulge or refuse, what you aspire to, what you look at, what you spend, what you don't spend, we are answerable to him for it all. Now, there is great freedom within the will of God. There is not a one-size-fits-all on innumerable matters. But if he is Lord, then there is nothing in this life that is off-limits to his oversight. There is nothing in this life that is off-limits to his discipline. There is nothing in this life that is off-limits to him calling for our perfection. When I was a kid, I grew up across the street from a teenager who ended up becoming a Roman Catholic priest. His name was Brendan Cahill. I think he teaches at St. Thomas University in Houston. And I'm the kid that went over and knocked on his door every day. Can you play? He would throw the ball with me. He would let me play pool in his garage with him. He would let me do all sorts of stuff. I was the new, annoying little seven-year-old that would come over every day. Can we play? And he would play. 15-year-old guy. He would play. He loved me. He played with me. But there was one moment. I'm a smart alecky 7 or 8 year old kid that watched too much TV and began to memorize commercials too much, right? And so when you start watching a lot of commercials, you begin to pick up phrases, sometimes phrases that had to do with certain gastrointestinal issues. And so I thought I would be cute one day by being in his household and playing along with him and then walking up to him and whispering in his ear saying, you know what you are? You are fill in the blank of gastrointestinal issue. What did he do? Didn't say a word. He picks me up underneath my shoulders and gently carries me out of his house and puts me on his front porch and quietly closes the door. He loved me. He played with me. And he wouldn't hold a grudge against me later, but he wouldn't tolerate that kind of unkindness. Brothers and sisters, that's my memory of who I think Jesus is. He will love you. He will play with you. He will not bear a grudge against you if you are in him, but he will not tolerate what is unholy. That's how it scandalizes me. Does it scandalize you? He's a scandal because he's more than a man. Second reason he's a scandal, he thinks of authority and power much differently than everybody else does. He doesn't exercise his authority in a way that you think people should or would. They come down the mountain, and Jesus charges them to tell no one what they had seen. It's that word rebuke again. Don't say a word about what you've seen. And we all, again, are wondering, why is he playing the shush card again? Wouldn't you want this to get out, right? Why the concealment? You ever wonder why God the Father, and I don't mean to be crude here, do you ever wonder why God the Father doesn't just let God the Son be killed in the massacre of the children that Herod orders? I mean, if there's power in the blood, why not just do it then? Why wouldn't it just count then? Why to go to all the problem and all the trouble of Jesus that Jesus had to go through before he gets to his cross? Why not let it happen then, right? It's his blood. It's his redemption. Why not then? If you pick a fruit before it's ripe, you can't enjoy its full sweetness. If you read the final chapter of a grand novel first, you don't know what prompted the story or the plot. You don't know what brings resolution to it, and the ending can't and never will have the effect it intends if it resolves the crisis before you ever knew what the crisis was. I love my wife, but she has a bad habit that in the middle of films, she will vocalize how she thinks it's going to end. And I will say, shh, let them tell the story. Jesus is going to die. But there's a meaning to his death that he's come to reveal. A meaning that has to be told, a meaning that has to be demonstrated. And so Jesus, I believe, asks repeatedly to conceal some aspect of his identity because he has a message to get out. And were some information to get out too soon or an unintended, distorted nuance to get out too soon, then Jesus can't complete his mission until he gets to his cross. That's why I think Jesus is saying, shh, zip it. And he says, zip it, because he wants to remind them why he has this authority at all. He's beloved of God, he's been commissioned by God, and therefore he's been empowered by God. But he's going to sacrifice his power. He's not going to mass an army, he's not going to solicit monies for a trust fund, he's not going to rise to elite status in any sense. Instead, he's going to walk into the arms of his enemies and let them kill him. And rather than punish who oppose him, he will ask his Father to forgive them. He's not going to cling to what is rightfully his. Instead, he's going to give it up for a larger purpose. Who does that with authority? Why is that scandalous? Look, Peter heard that kind of talk in last week's text, and what does he do? He rebukes Jesus to his face. It's not going to happen like that. God is strength and majesty and glory, Jesus. He doesn't let himself become weak, and certainly not before people who think they're strong. That's what Peter thinks last week. But that's exactly what Jesus did. And it's exactly what scandalized many then, and even the Apostle Peter. What about now? What Jesus does is a scandal to the world, to the church, and to you and me. It's a scandal to the world because the world finds it ridiculous that somebody would, who had the power, would not try to preserve it or expand it. Every one of these so-called scandals this week has at the root of it an interest in exercising power over another so that power might be retained. And I'll bet you, if somebody does a longitudinal study of all the news reports that come out over the next several weeks, I will bet you the one that gets the greatest attention is the one about the IRS. You know why? Because to the world, money is power. There's a scene in Schindler's List, a very hard film, when Oskar Schindler is sipping whiskey and smoking cigars with the commandant of the camp named Amon Goethe. And Schindler, in a moment, tries to convince Goethe to consider another option to his barbarism to Jews. He whispers in the ear, he says to Goethe, "Power is when we have every justification to kill and we don't. That's power. That's what the emperors had. A man stole something, he's brought in before the emperor, he throws himself down on the floor, he begs for mercy, he knows he's going to die, and the emperor pardons him. This worthless man, he lets him go. That's power. That's power." And for about 18 hours, Goethe entertains the idea that there might be more power exercised in pardoning than punishing. And it's only, though, a few hours before he can't stand it anymore. And he turns back to exercising his power through fear and murderous force. Now, it may not be a fair illustration, since not everybody that has power exercises it in that barbaristic way. But it does point to the seduction of having power and how it whispers to us, "Hey, it's yours. Keep it. Expand it. You're nothing without it." Unfortunately, it's not just the world that gets drunk on power, so does the church. And if you just have to look at church history to find examples of that over and over and over and over again, from ancient times to today. Too many instances when the church has sought to use force to enforce her will. I've quoted you several times James Hunter, who in some ways is the guy I'm borrowing most for sort of the vision for our church about faithful presence. Part of what motivates his desire to offer an alternative to how the church has ordinarily functioned is his own understanding of history and how the church has functioned. And there's a quote on the front of your page this morning that kind of summarizes why he thinks there needs to be a different way for the church to think about power. He says, "When Christians turn to law, public policy, and politics as the last resort, they've essentially given up on a desire to persuade their opponents. They want the patronage of the state and its coercive power to rule the day. And here's the tragic irony. Whenever Christian churches and organizations partake in the will to power, they partake in the very thing they decry in society." If you think the best way to make a new world is to enforce it by laws, brothers and sisters, we've done that before, and look where we are. There might be a different way, and that opens up a whole can of worms, I'm sure, among this community, and unfortunately, we'll talk about Q&A next week. His corrective might be an overcorrection, but we all would be best to listen. Because, brothers and sisters, look, it works in the world, it's scandalous in the church, and it's scandalous in us. Because you and I tend to use power in one of two ways. We either try to beat somebody else, or we just try to protect ourselves. Both are expressions of power. If I want to beat you, I'm going to try to win. I'm going to try to prevail. And if I value having power, I'm going to spare no expense to keep it or expand it. And I'll do so no matter what it costs you if you're the one challenging my authority. That's what we do with power, some of us. Some of us just try to win at all costs. Others of us, we just try to protect ourselves. We will not speak the truth just to keep what feels like peace. Now, that may not sound like it's using power, but it is. There's a passivity involved in protecting yourself, but it's not a pure passivity because you're actively trying to avoid something. Your protection becomes paramount, and you do all you can to keep a false peace. That's what we would do with power. And so whether you're trying to protect yourself or use your power, one thing is true of both of you. You're using it for your own sake. And Jesus scandalizes how we think about power because he refuses to play our games. He doesn't wield power just to prove that he has it. He uses it to further his Father's ends. And he doesn't sacrifice his power just for the sake of sacrificing it. He sacrifices it for the sake of wielding it for his Father's ends. It's what he doesn't do that allows him to do what we needed him to do for us. That's how he thinks of power. That's how he uses it. And it's that use of power that explains the last reason why Jesus is a scandal. He's a scandal because he's more than a mere man. He's a scandal because he uses his authority in a much different way. And thirdly, he's a scandal because the promise he offers is glory, but it's going to be through suffering. The transfiguration reveals his glory. But as they're walking down the mountain, Peter, James, and John break into this odd discussion about Elijah. Hey, they ask, why do the scribes say that Elijah must come? And Jesus says, look, Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how is it written? He asks his own question. How is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? What's the context? Don't turn there now, but if you were to look at Malachi chapter 4, the last book of the Old Testament, in the last chapter, in the last three verses of the book, Malachi promises that God's rule would come to the world once Elijah returned to, quote, turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. In other words, to restore the world to its intended goodness and glory. And the disciples are wondering, look, if you're him, Jesus, then where's Elijah? He should have come first. This is out of order. We're a little confused. And Jesus says, Elijah's been here, brothers and sisters. John the Baptist, is that Elijah? And he's come to restore all things by pointing to the one who would, namely Jesus. So Jesus is saying that this Elijah and this Son of Man are both going to suffer to see that restoration take place. But more importantly, what is true of them will be true of all who follow them. Remember what Jesus said last week? If anyone's going to come after me, he must deny himself and bear his cross and follow me. Now, why is that scandalous? I mean, the disciples ask about Elijah, but no one's like chafed or visibly or emotionally chafed, it would seem, about how suffering seems to be so much part of Jesus' project. Not in this text. There's no rebuke of Jesus here. There's no refusal to follow him. They just sort of go down the mountain and go, what's this part about rising from the dead? What is that middle part again? What did he say? But when Peter offers to set up the tents, told you I'd get back here, there's a subtle indication that Peter is still not getting it. That Peter doesn't yet get that Jesus' way is a way of suffering. Because, see, the tents that Peter is willing to put up were not for sleeping. These tents were for meeting, like the tent of meeting that God has with Israel back in the Old Testament, where Moses would meet with God. Peter believes that the glory that's coming there in the transfiguration is that final coming of the glory of God. This, he believes, is what Israel had been waiting for. The fullness of God's glory that had been promised is now the glory that's come to stay. That's what Peter believes. There's no outrage in Peter when he makes that offer. But he's assuming too much. He's concluding too much, and therefore he's, in all intents and purposes, forgetting that Jesus' way to glory is a way of suffering. And what that is, then, is just a kinder, gentler refusal to believe that the glory to come will be coming through suffering by Jesus and his followers. If I asked any of you point blank, do you believe Jesus' way is a way of suffering? I don't think anybody in here would deny that. You would say, absolutely. I know what the text says. Of course, but you and I can repeat Peter's error very subtly. you can come to Christ and trust His work on your behalf for the pardon of God, and then believe that there's no more work to be done either in your own soul or in the world. You can adopt a complacency that believes that what Jesus has done for you is all that He means to do in you or through you. But to believe that there will no longer be any struggle to experience in you or through you is in some subtle way to chafe against His call to glory through suffering. And so the more complacent you are, the more scandalized you really are about His call, even though you might not express any sort of outrage. As I said at the outset, if you don't in some sense see Him as an offense to how you work, you probably don't get Him. But if you never get past how He offends you, you never will get Him. And so let me end by answering this question. What do we do with all that? What difference does it make that He's a scandal? What do we have to do with the fact that He is? Three very brief things. You have to glory in Him. You have to listen to Him. And you have to suffer for Him. We see a glimpse of His true glory here. And we hear from Him that His path is to glory, both for Him and for us. And so the lesson we have from the fact that we see His glory is that we have to really see His glory as glorious, and therefore we have to find our glory in His. It wasn't just a magic trick that He was doing. It wasn't just for show that He revealed His glory. You and I have to find our meaning and our balance in Him. And in the words of Jeremiah, which I tend to quote early and often and will so till I'm blue in the face, he says, "Let not the wise man boast in his wisdom, nor the mighty man boast in his might. Let not the rich man boast in his riches, but let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me." To find your glory in God is to boast in Him, to say, He's enough, and if I lost everything else, I still have more than I need. That's finding your glory in Him. There's value in wisdom and might and riches, but none of it compares to the knowledge of God. And yet, we can live our whole lives as if what matters most is how wise, mighty, or rich we become. I had a friend recommend a book to me. Orson Scott Card is a sci-fi author, and he wrote a book about 35 years ago called Ender's Game. It's going to become a movie in November with Harrison Ford playing one of the leads, right? I got it in the mail. It's worth $6, right? I haven't cracked it but to read the introduction. But in the introduction, Orson Scott Card explains the surprise he experienced in the reception of his book. And he got a letter from a teenager, a 15-year-old, who was part of a gifted and talented program, and he was studying at a gifted and talented program at Purdue University. The book had so moved this young man because Card had created a character that deeply resonated with this young teenage soul. And in something that sounded like a confession, this kid confides in this author, and he says this: "All our lives, we've been unconsciously living by the philosophy, the only way to gain respect is doing so well that you can't be ignored. However, in choosing this path, most of us have ended up very satisfied in ourselves, but very lonely." That kid didn't know it, but he's articulating the animating principle of every human heart. If I can just do well enough to be respected, I'll find my glory. And I'll work so hard to do so well that they'll almost have to respect me. Nothing wrong with wanting respect. Nothing wrong with doing well. But brothers and sisters, what if there's a respect to be had that comes without having lifted a finger? And what if it's that respect that would motivate you to do as well as you can in gratitude for that respect? Brothers and sisters, that's the gospel. We gain our glory from the one who briefly showed His glory on the Mount of Transfiguration, not by our doing so well to gain His respect, but respecting what He did for you so that His respect becomes yours. That's the glory of the gospel. That's how you glory in Him, and that's also why you listen to Him. You listen to Jesus as you listen to no one else. You make His view of you and what He's done for you not the only thing you listen to, but the one thing that you most listen to. We believe most what we hear most. That's why we read. That's why we meditate. That's why we come and sit and listen to long sermons from such long-winded preachers. You have to hear it often and well to hope in it truly. But it's not mere listening that God tells us to do. He tells us to listen with a view to obedience. Paul warns Timothy that there are those who have an appearance of godliness, but they deny its power. They always learn and are never able to arrive at the knowledge of the truth. Brothers and sisters, there's a temptation to do much listening without much responding, and to substitute the listening for the responding. But listening entails responding and obeying. Otherwise, it's just eavesdropping. And that's why, if we're going to listen and listen well and listen with a view of obedience, we have to listen with one another. The imperative verb in the text, when God says, "This is my beloved son, listen to him," it's in the plural form. He's talking to y'all, yous guys, or whatever they might say back east. You don't listen well unless you listen with other listeners. You need one another to hear him and to hear him with a view to heeding him. That's what it means to listen. You glory in him, you listen to him, and finally you suffer for him. Not suffering for suffering's sake. You suffer for him. And per last week, you know, to suffer for him is to deny yourself for his sake. And to deny yourself for his sake is to deny yourself on the basis of his full glory. Jesus is greater and more than Elijah. Because yes, Elijah spoke for God and then was taken to heaven. But Jesus was God and then through him takes us to the new heavens and the new earth. Jesus is greater and more glorious than Moses, because yes, Moses received the law and gave the law, but it's Jesus who fulfills the law and is and let his record before the law become your own. And yes, Jesus listened to his Father, obeyed his Father like no one ever had, so that you and I would never have to suffer the internal silence of God. That's the glory of the gospel. That's the glory of Jesus. And those realities have to form the motive for our self-denial and our suffering. And the applications for that are too many to enumerate. It's hard to even know where to start to say, "Jesus, I will suffer for your sake." So let me suggest that self-denial begin this way. That you begin to put his reputation above your own. Some of you think the worst thing in the world is to look like a fool in the eyes of others. It's my problem. I don't want to look like an idiot in front of others. And you and I have the same problem. And if you believe that even mentioning Jesus to somebody that doesn't worship him is an invitation to ridicule, you will avoid it like the plague. But his respect matters most. Because it's his respect for you that gained you the eternal respect of God. And so suffering for him, if I might suggest just one new way, fresh way to begin thinking about it, means that you have to risk losing your reputation, even if it means elevating his. And rather than thinking when it comes to evangelism that you have to come up with an elaborate summary of the gospel, what if you just started with the question to someone, "Hey, what do you make of Jesus?" Ask a question. Then you're forgetting yourself, because you're finding your glory in the one whom God said, "Listen to him. He's my beloved son." Let me conclude this way. Jesus has been a scandal from the moment he came to earth, and he will be a scandal to many and more until he returns. But the offense he provokes is nothing compared to the offense that he came to forgive. And the more deeply we recognize that, the more willing we'll be to follow the scandal. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.